Last Word on Today FM.
For the week trending, we're joined by Aoife Barry, writer and broadcaster, and Tomás McDermott, who is the Managing Director of the Communications Clinic. Thank you both very much for joining us. You know, might as well talk a little bit about the weather of the week, because that's what everybody has been talking about. And it's made some people, put them in a very good mood. It's made some people a bit grumpy, I think. Particularly they get grumpy if you talk about it being too hot. That'd be fair to say, wouldn't it, Aoife?
Some people don't like when you talk about it being too hot, but it is too hot. So,
yeah, but you'll be complaining tomorrow it's not warm enough, won't
you? I know.
You?
I don't think you can win. And I think that the conversation is really complicated by the climate change conversation, because it's not like we're just having a nice summer. We're having extreme temperatures. And I keep thinking every time I look outside, what is it going to be like in 20 years' time? So I'm a bit of a fatalist when it comes to it, that I can't, like, I'm kind of enjoy the summer vibes, but I can also see the role that it plays in the...
See, Aoife, we're not actually having extreme temperatures. We're having very high temperatures for Ireland, but we're not facing what they're facing in Britain or continental Europe. Now, that's extreme.
That is extreme. And we're very lucky that we're not in France or Paris, where people are having to put chalk on their windows and foil on their windows, but we are experiencing this heat.
Sorry, what does chalk and foil do? We had Laura Marlow on for a great piece yesterday, but she didn't tell us she was doing that.
Yeah, it's to try and reflect back the sun so it doesn't get absorbed into the room where you're in. Because a lot of people, obviously, in Paris, for example, are living in buildings with like no aircon that are quite high. So that is, you know, they're inside the house sweltering.
Are they wearing tinfoil hats as well?
No, I don't. I don't think so.
Reflect it back.
I'm not sure about that, Matt. But like as Aoife has talked about, so it is quite hot. And an organisation who are very unhappy about it is the UN, where they're saying these savage temperatures are clearly and unequivocally linked to climate change. And like we've spoken on the show before about the David Wallace Wells book, The Uninhabitable Earth. That's no longer a prophecy. It's we're living it now, where we're seeing the places like France, where there are people dying, for example, who are unable to maintain any sort of and be able to deal with it. And we're seeing these kind of tropical nights that we're experiencing. We're seeing the domino effect on infrastructure, where energy prices are rocketing because people have to turn the aircon on. Power supply has been affected. We've seen it in France, where the power plants can't be cooled because the river water that typically cools them is too hot. And we're seeing the transport being affected through rail networks, airports. We're seeing tarmac had to melt. I think there's bridges being closed. So there is a significant knock-on effect to it. Now, what any of us will do about this remains to be seen, because like the parts of the Gulf have been uninhabitable for decades, if not millennia. Like, so nothing really has happened until now. We come to Europe and the impact that it's going to have, and whether or not we'll be able to see Europe, the European Union and elsewhere doing anything about it. Because if you take it to America, for example, we've seen forest fires in the West Coast there. Wildfires in the West Coast there. And so we're beginning to see this prophecy of Wallace Wells coming through.
You see, we also get told as well that it's better for the environment if people live in concentrated areas and cities. But when the temperature goes up, what do? They get out of the cities if they can, because it's hotter in the cities. And we also seem to have a situation whereby major European cities like Paris, like London, tend to overheat because of the concentration of people in them.
Yeah, and also because of things like when cities are designed, whether or not they have enough trees, for example. I mean, everybody knows the effect if you walk down a street and there's a lovely row of beautiful old tall trees on the left-hand side and nothing but concrete on the right-hand side. You go straight into the shade, the temperature is immediately lower. You know, we don't have a lot of that kind of planning maybe in some of those cities, particularly like I live on the north side of Dublin. You know, try and find a tree sometimes going down some of the streets I'm walking down. And all of that is kind of indicative of how much planning or thought has gone into planning these cities. And at the same time, when you're thinking about city planning, you know, 100 years ago, you weren't thinking that there would be a climate change disaster facing the earth, right? So there's that kind of element to it. But I guess that people are experiencing now the impact of decision making and lack of decision making around issues around climate by the decision makers in the world who have the most power to make change, who have not been making the change necessary, who've not been following the guidelines, who've not been listening to the experts telling us that we're going to be living in a world where the weather is constantly in flux, where we have extremes of cold and hot weather, where people are really at risk, where there are people living on islands now that are going to be disappearing because of the rising sea levels. You know, part of the reason why it gets so hot under a heat dome is because of the ice caps melting, and because there's not enough ice to actually absorb the heat.
But what about
the
argument? Sure, we'll adapt. We'll come up with, like, the way that, you know, it used to be flooding people put dams and dikes in place to make sure that there isn't flooding, and that we just adapt to the new circumstances that we have.
I think humans are going to have to adapt, and we are going to be adapting. You know, I was already thinking of things in my house like, oh, we need to do this and maybe do that because it's going to get much hotter in the summers when we do have more times of heat. But just because we're adapting, I think that we shouldn't forget about the fact that a lot of this could have been preventable by the people who actually have the power to curb the use of fossil fuels, to stick to the guidelines, to stick to the emission levels. You know, if they had actually done that and listened to the experts who have been shouting it from the rooftops, because we keep hearing them shouting it from the rooftops but being ignored, if they'd been listened to, we wouldn't be in this situation.
Well, as the listener says, was in Killarney for the last few days, it was like heaven with all the shade from the trees, and they give off a cool air as well. Aoife's correct about the trees and government sitting on their hands.
Yeah, I mean, look, like I kind of, the older I get, the more dispirited and cynical I get about things, where I'm like, a lot of this stuff is foreseen. We know what has to be changed in order to fight things like climate change, but the people that have the most power won't. Meanwhile, people in Ireland are getting stressed out about recycling, you know, bottles and things like that, that might have some impact, but won't have the kind of impact that actual curbs on fossil fuels and emissions actually would have.
Are you giving out about the recycling of the bottles?
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that the individual impact
really
is a lot as well. No, I'm not. I mean, recycling is great, but it's not the same as somebody stopping using fossil fields, like, yeah, do you know what I mean? Let's be honest.
With the amount of coal being burnt and...
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat meat. You know, I try to do my best, you know, so like we all do our own things. But like, as an individual, I have a lot less power than a person who is running a country or running a government to make massive decisions.
Sean in Cork says, on the north side of Cork City, the council has felled numerous trees to put in bicycle lanes.
That's one of those wonderful online arguments, isn't it? Like, we're not saying knocked out.
It's not either or.
Put up a parking lot, okay? Joni Mitchell was talking about this back in the 70s.
All right, okay. Anything else you want to add on about the weather?
Well, no, bar it's deeply uncomfortable sleeping at night is wrong. And like, yeah, you talk about the idea of us having to adapt. Like, if we look at having to adapt, the housing in Ireland, for example, is uniquely unequipped for this. Like, they're brilliant at trapping the heat, for example, to keep us warm during the cold months. But should we start seeing an increase in it, there will have to be adaptations made to this. And this has always been the challenge around sustainability and the climate, is that, yes, people see it as important, but it's actually in the top 10. It's probably closer to the end of that list, partly because it hasn't really affected them. But when it starts to hit the crunch, it ultimately then starts hitting people's pocket. They'll start to really begin to wonder whether or not this is relevant. And we've seen this in some elections where, for example, in Sweden, in relation to a right-wing government was elected, not necessarily for anti-immigration, but in part because of their sustainability strategy, because it was going to be increasing taxes. So the idea of, yeah, we'll have to adapt, I think there are some parts in relation to this that the challenge is going to be that government supports would be needed to make this doable for the general person listening.
Well, one listener suggests we should be like naming the storms, we should be naming these heat waves after fossil fuel companies.
Yeah,
so we could call this Heatwave Exxon or Heatwave Statoil or Heatwave Esso or whatever.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's like, but then you'd wonder will people eventually get very used to this idea, you know, be merrily suggesting other companies that could be named after without realising.
Well, actually, I just realised as well that yesterday we heard from Ian Guider about a big increase in the number of tourists coming to Ireland. Could it be that in the future we'll have more people flying in because we have a situation whereby we have tolerable climate.
Mm. Yes,
but then we'd have to ask ourselves, do we approve of all the additional flights coming in and where would people stay and all the rest of it?
Yeah, well, tourism is a key element in the Irish economy, and I suspect that the immediate reaction that people have is that they will accept it. But then again, if you look at, there are huge swathes around the world where people aren't living. The big challenge will be ultimately around migration and where will people go. For example, there's aspects of Canada that are totally empty. There's huge swathes of Russia that are totally empty. There's a whole load of theories about whether or not people will start migrating to them and whether it'd be a sensible thing to do. Mm. That's probably a bigger question than we're going to go through with it. But on a very basic level, I'd prefer if I had a beer and a swimming pool right beside me, Matt.
On to us. Tell us about Jeremy Doku, the Belgian winger who left his side's World Cup squad temporarily and is back there now, but all of the controversy that it has caused.
Yeah, so over the last few days, Matt, amid the high stakes drama of the World Cup over in the United States, a sideshow erupted that
some would say is firmly in the dark ages. And this is the Belgian and Manchester City winger Doku, who stepped away from the national camp to be with his wife for the birth of their first son, who's called Praise. And it seems that the entire Belgian squad were entirely supportive of him. But what we have seen is sections of the media and social media have thrown their toys out of the pram, most notably a French pundit who sparked a controversy and outrage by claiming that childbirth is a moment where the dad is useless and the World Cup should have taken priority. Doku has rejoined the team now and is back back with his teammates. But he has again gotten the support from Tielemans, for example, who has spoken out in support of him. But it's also probably worth noting as well, not that this I think would have made a difference, but Doku had been out sick as well with a respiratory illness, and that he wasn't going to play anyway. Now, maybe part of their familial plan was for him to visit his wife and be with his wife during it. But this has sparked a whole series of accusations about lack of loyalty to Belgium. Doku is from an immigrant family, for example, so there's thrown up some race questions around that. Racist questions, indeed. And they have also thrown up kind of masculinity questions and whether or not he should have been there. Yeah, and the toxic masculinity in relation to it. I think you look at it, Doku did what I think many of us would do and want to do, and the criticism of him is totally out of order. It does contrast, interestingly, to Leo Ostergaard, who was a Norwegian centre-back who watched his wife give birth over a video call. And what I found interesting there was that he described himself as exhausted after it.
Oh, the poor lad.
Which,
Not the thing to say.
It was a lot of hard work for him.
If I wonder as well sometimes, you know, when pundits, whatever, when they make these comments, whether they're doing it deliberately to get attention and to get ratings, as to whether this woman who said this really believed it.
Yeah, I think unfortunately outrage gets you clicks, outrage gets you attention, and there's a lot of people that are very willing to put up with outrage and say things they don't necessarily believe in order to get attention. Like, I wouldn't have known who France Pierron and L'Équipe necessarily are, and now I know who they are, and I know that this is a presenter on the show, and you know, I know that I don't agree with what she was saying, and I think that we do live in a kind of an outrage era where that is the fastest way to get people talking about you. If you know, if she had said something really complimentary and said, actually, isn't it wonderful that this person chose to make a very kind of difficult decision career-wise, not difficult decision family-wise. You know, if she praised him, said it was great, said what an amazing thing to do, you know, shows people, young men, a great example of fatherhood, etc., etc., she wouldn't have been covered by people in the media in Ireland because we give more coverage to negative coverage. But I do think it also shows that people still do have those stupidly old school attitudes around dads in the delivery room, which makes no sense.
But it's also this thing about commitment to the job, because on a separate note, Didier Deschamps, the French manager, is going to miss the next game because he's returned home to France because his mother died.
Yeah.
And I think that's utterly appropriate. But I can imagine, and I suspect that there have been occasions in tournaments in the past when managers have had a death in the family and they stayed on at work rather than going attend to family issues because they believe that's what's expected of them.
Yeah, and again, I think those are kind of attitudes that particularly like younger generations have more of have less of an issue speaking up against. You know, I think younger people are more likely to say, well, my life and my work and my family is more important than my job. Now, that's different, obviously, to a manager of an international team that are playing in a huge event. But I think that there is a sense now with people where it's like, what is more important? I mean, if your parent passes away, I'm sorry, but like, I would move mountains to be there for that. I think anybody would. I'm sure there's a huge amount of pressure on him, but the fact that he's doing that is actually way more meaningful, I think, than the opposite to that, because you don't only get that opportunity once in your life, and that is something that you will remember till your kind of dying days yourself. You know, and I think for Doku, he's only 24 years old, and you know, his first child, like, it's a really, I think it's a lovely thing to see, and in a way that, to me, there's no controversy at all about it. It's like people should be allowed to make their own personal family decisions around these hugely life-changing things if they want to. You know,
and the challenge, I think, sometimes with elite sport is that it has a long, suffocating history of treating the athlete as a commodity rather than a human being. And that what we are seeing here, as we're discussing, is a young man going home to be with his young wife who is having their first child.
Yeah.
What's unnatural or wrong about that? And I think it's totally appropriate. And similarly for Deschamps, the trauma of losing a parent on the other side of the world, you can understand why he would want to take some time out to be with his family and then travel back to be with his team.
And I suspect that if he hadn't, he'd been not much use. And whereas now when he can go and deal with this, he can come back for the rest of the tournament with his head in a better place.
Yeah, it would give that emotional clarity that would help with the leading of the team, and it wouldn't necessarily feel that he had left anything outside or that he could be somewhere else. So you can see that there would be both perhaps a personal benefit to him, obviously being with his family and being at his mother's funeral, as much as having the clarity then when he could come back to the team.
Okay, and we just mentioned racism. Tell us a little bit, please, Aoife, about what happened in Swords earlier in this week, when it seems that we had an attempted arson attack against housing, which I believe is owned by Ryanair and which it uses for staff on its flights, who most of whom are actually not Irish.
Yeah, it's such a shocking story. And there's footage as well online people might or might not have seen that shows this video of bins being set alight and pushed. Well, I don't know if the videos won't show them being set alight. They show them alight after being pushed in front of the doors of seven houses where workers for the airline live. And I cannot imagine the sheer trauma and fright that you would have of waking up in the middle of the night and realising there's a fire having been set outside your door at one of the exit or entry routes to your home. Really, really shocking. You know, fire service personnel were able to get extinguish the fires. There weren't any injuries, but I mean, I think people were lucky there weren't injuries. People who were involved, there's one Spanish man who works for Ryanair and lives nearby, doesn't live in one of the homes, but he was saying that, you know, they don't know, locals don't know if the issue was with the airline, was it with the fact that it's immigrants who are working, or people from other countries, should I say. You know, he's saying, like, we work here, we pay taxes, people go to Spain on their holidays, people in Ireland move to Spain. You know, he couldn't understand if people had why people might have had an issue. There's two 21-year-olds from Spain. They work as cabin crew for Ryanair, and they basically woke up in the middle of the night hearing shouts and screams at around 3 a.m. and discovered that the bins had been set alight and pushed against the front of neighbouring properties. They were afraid and thought the houses themselves were on fire, but thankfully they weren't. Ryanair has condemned the attack, and it's added that Irish and EU employees live in that area. And it's, I suppose, it's the kind of thing that it's very sinister and would put people on edge, I think, as well. And where we are living in a time where we are seeing really horrendous things happening to people in Ireland of different races and different backgrounds, and this is another kind of flashpoint where you're really worried about people and can only imagine the impact on people living there. I'm sure people didn't really sleep very well for the last number of nights following that.
Yeah, it's deeply unsettling, and I'm from Swords, born and bred, and very proud to be from Swords, so it's very upsetting and disappointing to see something as horrific happening there. And just again to echo what Aoife talked about, the idea that people be waking up in their homes at 3:30 in the morning where there's bins up against the door is absolutely shocking. And again, to understand the context of a little bit more about this, Matt, you'll remember that Ryanair bought, I think, 25 out of the 28 homes in this estate.
Which was controversial.
And at the time, it did throw up a significant kind of national debate about whether corporate entities should be buying up housing estates. But if you bring it back to this week, then we're seeing kind of the ugly, violent flashpoint of that tension that's occurring, and whether it is based around housing grievances or anti-immigrant rhetoric, it's absolute thuggery. And we were, you know, we're speculating that one could argue it could be attempted murder, for example.
Okay, something else a bit lighter than that. You go to loads of gigs, Aoife. You've been a music journalist in your time.
Yeah.
Were you at Metallica?
No, I wasn't. My partner was at the two Metallica gigs. Gave a thumbs up to them. He was delighted.
And why didn't
I
wasn't as well?
I wasn't at Metallica. Yeah, I'm not. I suppose I'm not as big of a Metallica fan. I was kind of regretting. I've never seen them live, so I was kind of regretting it. But yeah.
Okay, but the story here is about the three American brothers, young fellas, who got arrested over their fake Metallica snake pit wristbands, and who ended up in remanded in custody, spending time in a jail cell quite a few days, I think.
Yes, they came over on holiday I think they were in the UK as well, then in Ireland. They were in Scotland, then around the UK, then came to Ireland. And for some reason, and the details weren't really explained exactly how or why they decided to do this, they ended up with counterfeit wristbands to get into the Snake Pit, which is the VIP area of the Metallica gig. They were students of criminology, business and music. You know, the court heard that they were naive, made a stupid mistake when they got involved in the fraud. There was three brothers from Florida. You know, the idea that they'd come over here to see the gig, get involved in this, and now have their photographs and a court report there for anybody to see and have spent a night in custody. It's pretty shocking stuff. You know, they said it was a stupid mistake. They apologised for it and they had to, I believe, pay a fee or pay maybe into the court poor box or something like that. Yeah, charity donation.
They have a chance in their arm, like many people do.
It's very excessive, isn't it?
It's kind of mad that I did not realise that if you actually counterfeited a wristband, you would end up in a night in the cells, you know. It does seem like I would have assumed the person would just have the wristband taken off them and maybe just
turfed out of the event.
And how many people over the years have slipped off a wristband to give it to somebody else?
Yeah, I mean, that's not unusual. Like, I guess I'm always curious about the circumstances of these arrests as well, too, because we've probably all seen incidents where things can go from maybe the guard might let this go to actually the guard ain't going to let this go now because something was said or done or whatever. So I don't know what...
It was a bit of cheek given.
Yeah, like the guardie obviously aren't a big fan of cheek. I don't know if these guys did. Again, I have no idea. I wasn't there. But I don't know. Or maybe I just don't know the law around this, which is likely, you know, maybe it is actually... you know, par for the course, but I don't know anybody, you know, who's ever shared a story similar to that before.
I think the biggest crime was going to Metallica in the first place.
Like icons. No, I didn't go. I did give a serious consideration, but really? Yeah.
Why?
Because the music's good on Tomas. Nigel Farage went on radio and television, a round of interviews on Tuesday to celebrate, as he would see it, 10 years after the Brexit referendum victory that he claims an awful lot of credit for. But instead of being asked a lot about that, every interview suddenly decided, well, now's the time to ask him about the £5 million sterling gift that he got from a crypto guy who lives in Thailand under a false name a lot of the time or under a different name. Can you just imagine the fuss there would be in Ireland if we heard that a politician had got £5 million and was doing nothing for it? Let's just hear a little bit of how our own friend on The Last Word, Nick Ferrari, on his morning breakfast programme, challenged Nigel Farage about that.
I've got to ask you a question about this £5 million gift from this crypto billionaire. You know better than most politicians how LBC works. I'm getting comments as you and I are speaking. This man needs to tell us, what has he done with the £5 million? Get him to be truthful. Nigel Farage, please, what has happened to this £5 million gift?
With all due respect, what's it got to do with you?
Well, because it speaks to the position of what you hold in office. Initially, we were told that it was because of your personal security and it would pay for that for the rest of your life. Then apparently it was some kind of reward for campaigning, for Brexit. I am told we have two different stories. Which is the truth? Well,
I think you're contradicting yourself there, aren't you?
Well, if you tell me what happened with the £5 million, then we're solved.
It's an unconditional gift. I can spend it on Ferraris if I want. That'd be entirely up to me.
Why did you say it was for personal security then?
Because it was given as an unconditional gift, right? Understanding is, and you know very well, I've been physically more attacked over many years than any other policy.
I've been with you when you've been abused. Yeah. I've seen that. But my listeners want to know, Mr. Farage, how much has been spent?
I can deal with it as I want. I can do what I want with it. Well, I can put it on the horses.
Yes, you are under review, though, by the Parliamentary Standards Commissioner.
Well, and maybe we shouldn't be discussing it in that case. But what I will say to you is, I know that I will need protection until I die.
Okay, there's a few things in there. He surely hasn't heard of Bertie Ahern trying to use putting it on the horses as an excuse. That didn't work out too well. The idea that he's been more attacked by anybody else, tell that to the families of Joe Cox and David Amass, two members of Parliament who have been murdered in the last decade. I think the most that's ever happened to Farage is that he had a milkshake thrown at him. And we've had plenty of politicians here in Ireland as well who've had that done. So maybe there are security requirements, but he doesn't seem to have spent the money in that. He's trying to claim he wasn't active in politics at the time he took the money. He's been active in politics for decades at this stage. And what do you make of all of this, Owen?
Yeah, well, as probably many people listening, my view of Nigel Farage is that he is a charlatan. And what we have seen in his recent broadcast media rounds, whether it's with the BBC or LBC, as we just heard with Nick Ferrari, ITV, Sky News, is that what we're seeing is a kind of a political or unfavourable masterclass in political distraction, deflection and defiance. One of the things he says is that the public don't care about it, but there was review and a survey from Servation that found that 68% of the public are actively concerned about this £5 million gift, and roughly half of those currently vote for reform. So that'll be a challenge for him. It's also a challenge to how he has presented himself as in his political identity, where it's been built on this kind of ordinary, nice guy, has a laugh, pint in the pub bloke, and that he's detached from the wealthy wealthy elite, which is that now he is very clearly totally attached to the wealthy elite, where he is getting this £5 million gift. And then, as we have heard with Nick Ferrari, the story is changing. So, as we know, Matt, from in a political situation, ideally they stick to the one story. He's bounced within three in the one interview.
He also has said that, you know, he didn't do it, he would do it, or he hadn't do anything for money. He's done nothing. However, he has talked up crypto, and this guy has been a major donor, not just to him personally, but to the political party. He says he would do nothing for money. However, previously, do you remember he used to make videos?
Mm-hmm.
And you would actually, for 85 quid sterling, you would get in contact and he would do birthday greetings.
Okay.
And he would do things. Once he actually did do a Chucky Garlaw video.
Mm-hmm.
And another time he did an Up the Ra video. And when he was challenged on that, he just said, well, I'll do anything for money. So what is it? Do you do nothing for money, or do you do anything for money?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're looking for absolute purity of the message, and if you're looking for someone who sticks to one thing and who comes to it with, you know, good faith and who you can really trust, then I wouldn't turn to Nigel Farage on that. Instead, you're getting obfuscation. You're getting a million different reasons as to why he got the money and what he's doing with the money. You know, it's like listening to an episode of The Thick of It, where halfway through the conversation, it's announced that he's being investigated by the Standards Commission about it. You know, like, this is a big deal. It's not just like a small little thing. And the Conservatives reported it to the Standards Commission, and that's why they're investigating it. You know, so it's just like, it's another example of someone who says their one thing, which is, I'll stick it to the elites, and actually ends up then obfuscating the truth about money that he got.
If, of course, Brexit was largely about getting back their blue passports.
Yes,
they didn't want the passports, the purple passports,
yeah,
like EU citizens have. And they're welcome to their blue passports, and they can stand in the longer queues in all the airports around Europe and wield them. But tell us about the new Irish passport, because as it happens, your individual EU passports might have a colour in common on the cover, but you can have all sorts of distinguishing national identities within them, can't you?
Yeah, well, I mean, the new Irish passport, which has a lot of different security features, also has a wolfhound in it, which I think is really lovely, and was made with the consultation of different people, you know, including artists, people who were asked about what they thought should go on the passport. You've also got kind of different kind of heritage items and things like that. So, and I think it's just really nice that, like, we kind of have this idea of what Irishness is and how we reflect it in the passport. As well, I think there's 15,000 people took part in the consultation, so that's really nice. They didn't ask me to take part in it, but I really like what they do with it. There's also a lot of enhanced security features. So, I mean, if you have your current one, you can't change it. Obviously, you're going to have to wait for a little while. But it's the first time, I think, that some of these security features have been used in a passport anywhere in the world, which I think I hadn't realised is quite that we're a little bit ahead of things there. So there's landscapes, wildlife and natural heritage all reflected on it, and not in a diddly-eye way, I think, properly getting in touch with Irish heritage.
No, and the wolfhound, it's like what it represents, and that idea of it's fitting the qualities, guardianship, loyalty, strength, for example, and it's tasked with protecting a document that's there for our global
just
identity.
Like it used to protect our previous president.
Well, yeah, indeed. And but like, I think it does give us a moment to remind ourselves of the sheer unadulterated power of the Irish citizenship. And the Irish passport is consistently ranked in the top three of the most powerful travel documents on earth, where it gives our citizens visa-free access to over 186 countries. So it's unique, and it has a unique advantage, and it's a wonderful little book that allows us travel around the world, and that we should be incredibly proud of it.
I think that's probably a nice element to finish on. Thank you very much, Owen Tomás McDermott and Aoife Barry, for being with us on The Week Trending.
The Last Word on Today FM.